Revelation chapter 21. We're coming to the close of this great book, and I think the things that we'll be able to look at in the next couple of classes here are things that lift us up and encourage us, make us want to go to heaven. Some of the greatest chapters in the whole Bible, I believe, in terms of that. And I trust that we'll at least try to do them justice as we go through these great passages. We're going to start in Revelation chapter 21 today as we talk about the destiny of the redeemed. And we'll be looking particularly at verses 1 through 8 as we start. Please read these with me. John says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away.' Then he who sat on the throne said, 'Behold, I make all things new.' And he said to me, 'Write, for these words are the true and faithful.' And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death.'" As we begin looking at these verses, we're introduced through John's vision to a new heaven and a new earth, an entirely new realm of existence that's characterized by righteousness. And what a wonderful thing. I saw a post yesterday on Facebook. Someone was asking, when will the bad people get what's coming to them and the good people get what's coming to them? And the great thing as we look forward to heaven is it's a place where righteousness dwells and righteousness reigns. And we won't have to put up with the unrighteousness and the unfairness that we call it sometimes in the world in which we live. John saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth were passed away. And it reminds me of something that Peter writes in 2 Peter chapter 3, where he also refers to the passing of heaven and earth and the new heaven and the new earth. In 2 Peter chapter 3, in verse 10, he says, "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise. The elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which dwells righteousness." So the things we'll be looking at in Revelation 21 this morning are things that we need to be looking forward to. This new heaven and new earth in which dwells righteousness. What a wonderful place it will be. John also says in this verse that there will be no more sea. And interpreters, as well as friends and brethren, take a couple of different tactics or interpretations, I should say, when it comes to that particular statement, that there would be no more sea. My understanding of it is this, from just looking at how the word sea is used in the book of Revelation. I believe that the sea in the book of Revelation typically refers to human society in its connection with the earth where evil men dwell, and human society with all of the inherent evils and problems that we have in society. That's really what the sea is, I think, in the book of Revelation. Let's go back and be reminded of some of the ways the word sea is used in Revelation. Notice in Revelation chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, when the second angel sounded that trumpet, and the second of the seven trumpets, second angel sounded, And something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood. You might remember when we studied that, we talked about this mountain probably referring to a kingdom of some sort. And it's thrown into the sea and it affects the sea. And a third of the living creatures died and a third of the ships were destroyed. Well, you don't get a whole lot out of that, but you definitely get the sea as something that needs to be punished. Well, the waters where the fish live don't really need to be punished in a literal sense. That has to represent something else. What needed to be punished? What needed for God to get its attention so that it would repent? Well, again, that sea, I think, represents human society. Look at Revelation 12 and verse 12. Revelation 12 and verse 12. Here John says, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea." Well, I don't think he's talking about fish and dolphins there. Okay, I think the inhabitants of the sea that are going to be punished are people. And again, you see this connection throughout. "But woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." And then look at chapter 16 and verse 3. "As the bowls of wrath are being poured out, as the we saw in the second trumpet, so the second bowl of wrath affects the sea. The second angel poured out his bowl on the sea, and it became blood as of a dead man, and every living creature in the sea died." And then in chapter 18, when those who are allied with the beast and the false prophet, the evil people who had persecuted the church, when Babylon falls, this is one of the laments that we looked at in chapter 18, starting in verse 17. "In 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out, and they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What is this great? What is like this great city?' They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she is made desolate.'" In these references, and again, I think probably others that we could look at, the sea appears to be a place where tumultuous human society is being depicted. Now, when you get back to Revelation 21, as far as the kind of human society that we have on earth, and all of the problems we have with human society on earth, is any of that going to be in heaven? No. None of that's going to be in heaven. The sea that's in heaven, every time the sea is depicted in heaven, it's described as a sea of glass, clear as crystal. And so the concept there is the perfection of human society, that our relationships with others will be perfect and beautiful, not like it is on earth. And so I think there's a beautiful symbolism there. So getting back to Revelation 21, when he says there's no more sea, I truly believe that that is what he's talking about, that sea of the world. The New Jerusalem is the perfect dwelling place for God's people. In trying to understand what the New Jerusalem is or what it represents, friends and brethren have taken a couple of different views of this. One view is that it represents the church as it is now. And people that take this view will say that really Revelation 21 and the first part of 22 is not really a description of heaven, but of the church as it is now. And there is some merit to that interpretation. But I think by far, in my mind at least, the overwhelming amount of evidence is that the New Jerusalem, this heavenly city, represents heaven itself and the experience of the saved in that city. And I'm going to present a little bit of evidence along that line for your consideration. But notice, John sees this holy Jerusalem, New Jerusalem, and this holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. Well, you can look at that phrase, and we know that the bride of Christ is the church. So you can definitely see why somebody would be thinking immediately, this is talking about the church. But the question The question is it talking about the church as it is on earth, or is it talking about the church triumphant in heaven? And I believe it's the latter. There's no doubt it's talking about the church in one manifestation or another. But let's look at a couple of passages back in the book of Hebrews that might shed a little bit of light on the concept of the heavenly city. You look at Hebrews 11 and verse 10. Hebrews 11 and verse 10. These people of faith, like Abraham, it says that he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, that doesn't really tell us a lot about what that city is, but most of the time when we read that passage, Tracy, I timed out. Most of the time when we read that passage, we think of heaven, probably. Abraham looked for that city. Somebody could make an argument that he's looking for the establishment of the church, the salvation of men, the promises that were made to him really came to fruition in the church as well. So you could make that argument in Hebrews 11 and verse 10. But look at chapter 12, verses 22 and 23, where the city here is most definitely the church. The Hebrew writer says, "You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, and to the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, the blood of the sprinkling that speaks of better things than that of Abel." That appears to be a description of what we have in the church in the spiritual sense. But then look at Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 14. Here, the writer says, "Here we have no continuing city." So the city that we're looking forward to, and I think really getting back to what Abraham was looking forward to, is not a continuing city. The city we're looking forward to is a continuing city. Here we have no continuing city, the text says in verses 13 and 14. We seek the one that is to come. So the city here in Hebrews chapter 13 is something that wasn't yet. It was yet to come. And I believe that's the city that's being described in Revelation 21. Let's see if I can get this back on. Pardon the interruption. Ah, thanks. This New Jerusalem is the perfect dwelling for the people of God. The other little bits of evidence that I'd like to offer as we're trying to identify what this city represents. The second bit of evidence, besides looking at these references in Hebrews, is to notice the place of the vision of this city in the flow of the book of Revelation. We've already had in the book of Revelation the final judgment, Revelation 20, right? Where everybody's before the throne of God and books were open, the devil and all those who were not found written in the book of life were thrown into the lake of fire. And now we're seeing the heavenly city. Well, it looks like then this depiction of the heavenly city comes after the final judgment. And so in the flow of the book of Revelation, makes much more sense to me, at least, to understand this as being a description of heaven. The other little bit of evidence that I would offer to demonstrate this is just the characteristics of the city that are described in Revelation, some of which are not true of the church. Look at chapter 21 and verse 4, which we read, but notice this carefully. "God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying." If we ever have any sorrow and crying in the church? Lots. Sometimes we need it when we are turning away from sin, and we need it to share our feelings of love for those who are going through times of sorrow and all of that sort of thing. Well, there's not going to be any of that in this heavenly city. And so, again, looks like that's not going to apply to the church, but would apply to things in the heavenly realm. You can look at verse 27. chapter 21, there shall by no means enter it anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Well, in the church, as it exists on earth, I'm afraid we have some things that enter into it, that cause abominations and defile. In fact, Paul writes extensively in 1 Corinthians about things that were being done in Corinth that were defiling the church. And he condemns them for defiling the church. And so, it looks like to me that that wouldn't apply to what we have in the church today. And then in chapter 22, verses 4 and 5, as you come to the conclusion of the description of the city, it says that they shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp of light or of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. Three things in that passage that say to me that this is talking about heaven. The first of them is, they shall see his face. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2 says, brethren, that we are the children of God. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. We're going to see him face to face when he returns. Okay, so we're not particularly doing that now. That's a future thing. They're going to see his face, Revelation chapter 22 and verse 4 says. It says that there's going to be no night there. Nobody needs the sun. Well, again, in this world, we need the sun. There, we don't need the sun. And the third thing is, they're going to reign not for 1,000 years or a limited period of time, but what does it say? Reign forever and ever. Right. So it looks like from all of that, again, to my way of thinking, there is some reason to think somebody might say it would be the church on earth, but I think the evidence is a lot stronger that it's definitely this passage is referring to heaven. And the thing about it is what's said is the tabernacle of God is with men. Well, what was the tabernacle in the Old Testament? What did that represent? What did people go into the tabernacle for? To worship God, to approach God. And it was the place where once a year the high priest went into the very presence of God, to the mercy seat with the blood for his sins and the sins of the people. So here is where man makes his connection to God and comes into the presence of God finally and at last. And now the tabernacle, the dwelling of God, is with men. And he will be with them. And they will be his people. And so you have this close fellowship between God and his people that will last through all eternity. What a wonderful thing. You know, people, when I think about heaven, there are a lot of glories concerning heaven. And the Bible describes a lot of wonderful things about it. But there can be nothing greater than just to be in the place where God is. Just to be in the place where God is and where he dwells. And so that is, I think, what's being said. The tabernacle of God is with men. He will dwell with them. They shall be his people, and God himself will be their God. That fact, by the way, I think accounts for the truth that there's not going to be any tears or death or sorrow or pain. He who overcomes will inherit these things, verse 7 says. These things are related to our inheritance. That, I think, is also another indication that this is heaven and not the church. You receive this as an inheritance. This is the final outcome of being a child of God. We look forward to an inheritance, the riches that are to come, that we receive as being God's children. We have to overcome in order to receive them. We have to overcome in order to receive them. In stark contrast to this blessedness that's described here and this existence that all of us long for, where we're with God and there's no crying, there's no pain. And I just look forward to that, don't you? Nobody has to die anymore. Nobody has to die anymore. What a great thing. In contrast to that, you have those who are in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. The contrast could not be any sharper. People who will never again experience death. in contrast to people who are always experiencing death. Forever and ever. A terrible thing. A lake that burns with fire and brimstone. And those who are in it, and I know we've studied this, I'm sure this is a passage most of us are familiar with. We made our children learn it when they were young, especially the part about lying, where all liars will go. But the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, all liars shall have their part. You don't want to be any of those things. You don't want to be any of those things because you'll have your part then in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. It really motivates you to holiness and to living a Christ-like life, to think about the completely opposite, polar difference in the destinies of those who are redeemed and those who live lives such as described here in this passage. Y'all have comments. I've said a lot, and this is a rich text. I'm sure many of you have thought a lot about this text before. Does anybody have a thought you'd like to bring out or a question? Now, you know, the riches of this life, I think what Albert is saying is, are inconsequential when it comes to the riches of eternity. And God is going to do exactly what He said in giving His riches to His children and withholding them from those who are not His children. And we need to live lives in such a way that we're preparing to go to heaven as children of His. That's a wonderful point. Well, let's go on and look at the next few verses. And by the way, I've tried to share visuals with you, and I see the book of Revelation in pictures myself. I encourage others to do that. Here would be, I think, a fairly accurate drawing of what John saw. And you'll understand more and more why this is accurate, I think, as we read the next few verses. But you remember this old song we used to sing? In the land of fadeless day, or an endless day, lies a city four square. You remember that? Well, that concept comes out of Revelation 21, and I think we'll see why in a little bit. This particular picture is, I think, very accurate in a lot of ways. The color looks to me to be correct. The city looks like it's coming down from heaven. As we'll see in a minute, the color is described as sardius, which is a red gemstone. And so that's what John saw. Here's what we read as we look at verse 9. Read with me. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me, saying, "Come and I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. And so that's what we're seeing in these artist depictions of what John saw. Again, there's a good bit of accuracy, I think, in these particular representations. And then he says, also she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. Three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three gates on the south, three gates on the west. Now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he who talked with me had a gold reed to measure the city, its gates and its walls. The city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its breadth. And he measured the city with the reed, 12,000 furlongs. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. And he measured its wall, 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. The construction of the wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with all kinds of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. What a beautiful description of a beautiful place. What you see in this perfect city for the saints is that the number 12 features prominently. Did everybody notice how many 12s are in that? Lots of references to something being 12 in number. And even things that weren't 12, like, for instance, the width of the wall of the city is 144 cubits. The length, breadth, and height of the city is 12,000 furlongs, 12,000 12 times 1,000. So everything related to the city seems to be connected to the number 12. It's illuminated like a jasper stone that's clear as crystal. You might remember us talking when we saw the throne scene in chapter 4 about the throne of God being translucent and sort of described as like a jasper stone. And so heaven itself is that way. It has this great high wall, a wall that surely suggests to us security. It's completely unassailable. It's a great and high wall. You know, people, they built the Great Wall of China to protect China from invading forces, foreign countries. And the Great Wall of China actually would have been very successful as a defense against invaders, except that its gatekeepers took bribes. And so people were able to invade, not because they could scale the wall, but because they could go through the gates by bribing the gatekeepers. There are no bribes, you know, to get into heaven. And nobody's going to scale this wall. It is highly defensible. So again, the number 12 figures prominently. What's the number 12 all about? What does it mean? What's the significance of it as we've seen in the book of Revelation? It's the number of God's people, for sure. We saw the 12 tribes, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes in chapter 7. We saw a woman in chapter 12 with a garland of 12 stars on her head who obviously represented the people of God. And so throughout the book of Revelation, this number 12 represents the people of God. You think about the 12 sons of Jacob bringing us the 12 tribes, right? The 12 tribes, and then you have the 12 apostles. Those numbers aren't accidental. So throughout really the Bible, but especially throughout Revelation, 12 is a number for the people of God. It was with Israel in the Old Testament and with the church in the New. So what if I said, now the thing that characterizes you, that is most characteristic of you, if somebody were to describe you and talk about you, and the first thing that they would think of is 12. Mel is 12. Okay? Well, if I built a house for Mel, you know what I'd do? I'd put 12 trees in the yard and 12 rooms in the house and 12 ways to get in to the house and 12 windows in the walls. And everything would be 12 because Mel is 12. You get it? We are 12. We're 12. And everything in heaven is 12. You think about, well, am I going to fit in there? You ever wondered that? Well, how will I? Will I feel that, you know, like I'm at home in heaven? Absolutely. It's a place that's made for you. Hell is made for the devil and his angels. Heaven is made specifically for you. I tell this story of when we moved to Athens in 1994, we bought a house out on Log Cabin Road that I think I might have sold, by the way. But we bought a house out on Log Cabin Road, and we didn't get to draw the plans for it, but we did get to pick out some plans and also make some adjustments as to where the windows were going to be and where the light plugs were going to be and the electric sockets and the light switches and all of that. So we did get to make some choices. We took out a wall in one place. And so we did get to make some changes to the design that we thought would suit us. Well, I hadn't been in the house 2 days till I discovered that the light switches were in the wrong place. Okay, my fault. That's where I said I wanted them to be. God knows us intimately. wonderful. He knows exactly what we want, what we need, what we're made of. And He has designed heaven for us. He has designed heaven for us. And it just ought to make us yearn to be there. In heaven, you have 12 gates all the way around the city, all for the people of God. All the people of God can get in there. 12 angels at those gates. The names of the 12 tribes written on the gates. This is a place that just says, like a big sign, this is a place for the people of God. The names of the 12 tribes. And on the foundations, what's on the foundations of the city? What's written on those foundations? The names of the 12 apostles. In Ephesians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul talks about the foundation of the church, that we've been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone. And let me get off just a little bit of a tangent here, I think. In talking to religious people in some in different denominations at times, I don't know about you, but I definitely get the feeling that some people just regard the words of the apostles as the words of men. There are those in the religious world who, you know, if it's not in red letters in your Bible, then it's just a man said. That's the way they look at it. The apostles of Christ speak with the authority of Christ. Jesus told them twice, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Matthew 16, 19, and also in chapter 18. He told them that twice. The church is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Paul said that if anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things that I write to you are the commandments of the Lord. And so the apostles have divine authority. And I say all that to say, could it possibly just be an accident that their names are on the foundations of heaven itself? You're not going to go there if you have this idea that they're just men. Their names aren't on the foundations of heaven because they're just men. Their names are on the foundations of heaven because they're representatives of Jesus Christ. And so what they had to say to us, we need to really pay attention to that. Their names being here, I think, is very, very significant as in terms of their work for the Lord in saving mankind. The dimensions of the city are 12,000 furlongs, which is 1,500 square miles. So you think about a city, the wall breadth, width, and height being, did I say 15,000? 1,500. I'm bad with numbers. 1,500 miles. The width of the wall is 144 cubits, and that's a wall that's 216 feet. You know, two-thirds of a football field. That's a thick wall. You have, I think, in all of that, the concepts of security, certainly. You have the idea that we're going to be safe there. Of course, all of God's enemies and all of our enemies have been vanquished anyway. But we're going to be in a place that's just unassailable. Perfectly secure. Perfectly secure. What about the fact that the 12 gates, you have three on each wall that face all four directions? What does that suggest to us? Three facing north, three facing south, three facing east, three facing west. Entrance points from, all over the, from the four corners of the globe, so to speak. People coming into it from all nations. And that goes along with how it's described here momentarily, all nations will bring their glory to it. Chapter 21 and verse 24 will tell us. So let's go on and look at that little next section. As John is shown this city by an angel, notice in verse 22, I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. Again, there's no need for a tabernacle, no need for a temple. God's presence is there. This is where He is. And so you are with Him if you're in this city. The city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine on it. We said already, the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. Jesus came as a light into the world. He said, I am the light of the world. And now He's illuminating heaven itself. The nations of those who are saved, and the idea of the nations there, I think, refers to people of all ethnic backgrounds, nationalities. The nations of those who are saved will walk in its light. The kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. I think the kings of the earth there need to be contrasted with the kings of the earth who gave their allegiance to the beast, who wailed and wept when the beast was destroyed, and who themselves then were already cast into the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. The kings of the earth are specifically mentioned in that context. Here, these kings of the earth are those who are saved through the blood of the Lamb. These kings of the earth, leaders of people on earth, are those who have been redeemed through Christ's blood. And the idea of them being kings may or may not be literal. It could just refer to spiritual royalty, so to speak. And I think I know some people who are spiritual royalty, who are princes and princesses of God. But in any case, the gates are not going to be shut by day, and there shall be no night there. So the gates are open. Access to all of the redeemed, to all of the children of God. And they bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. Anything that we do in this life, whoever we are, wherever we're from, whatever nationality we may be, that we do to glorify God, will take to heaven with us. Our glory, the glory of the nations, is really in eternity only the glory that we've given God in this life. That's what we'll take with us into eternity. That's why it's so important, friends and neighbors, that every day we seek to glorify God with our lives. Every day. That's what's going to heaven with us. And when we get there, we'll be so glad we did. Paul talks about his crown of rejoicing in the presence of Christ being those that he brought to Christ. Think about all of the glory, all of the people that Paul brought to Jesus. That's going to be what he takes to heaven with him. That's his crown of rejoicing before his Lord and Savior. People that you've talked to about the Scriptures, people that you brought to Christ, things that you did for the cause of Christ, those are the things that will bring glory into the city and honor your King. On the other hand, there shall by no means enter anything that doesn't belong. Again, in looking at verse 27, anything that defiles, causes an abomination or a lie, only those written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Now, I always like to make this point on this verse. People say, I just wish everybody can go to heaven. Everybody could go to heaven. Well, if everybody would have faith in Jesus, believe in the gospel, live a holy life, I would too. But as far as if you're talking about everybody staying as they are and going to heaven, no. It wouldn't be heaven. It wouldn't be heaven. If people who could bring their lies, their abominations and all, it'd be the same thing we have on earth, wouldn't it? Who wants that? The reason that everybody can't go to heaven is because if everybody did go to heaven, it would not be heaven. And the passage clearly says that there are those who cannot go because of what they would bring into it. All right, we have just one more chapter to cover. Thank you so much for your good attention and your patience with me as I kind of ramble around and talk about it. And I hope you're being edified by it.